We've finally done it, Dave.
What are we doing?
Well, 92 episodes in, and we're finally fulfilling all the podcaster's dreams, recording in a closet. To the 9-8 podcast, the home of the progressive underground right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and every show I'm joined by Mr. Dave Ellis. Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Now, look, we've got to be really honest here. Things are going to sound a little different for this episode, and that is because, as you probably just heard, we're recording in a closet. And yeah, we are recording in a closet.
Yes.
Because I've managed to jump on a plane 5 hours across the wonderful continent that is Australia. And I'm actually sitting in Alex's closet. We're waving at each other. This is great.
As opposed to the last time when we did this, when I was giving you the finger.
Yeah. Now, look, before we jump into today's show, a quick reminder to everyone listening that if you aren't subscribed already, please follow or subscribe the podcast wherever you're listening. Leave us a review and share this show with your prog friends. This greatly helps us expand the reach of our show. And also, we do have a Patreon. So if you can't get enough of two people screaming into the ether about everything to do with progressive and underground music, you can help us on Patreon keep this show running. There'll be a little bit more about that at the end of the show with after shows and all that kind of stuff. But it's great to be here in West Oz.
It is.
Unfortunately, literally flew in and masks were back on. Things got cancelled. Didn't get to see some live music that I was hoping to see. But it was good to be here for obviously my birthday. We won't disclose how great I am getting these days. But it's a nice part of the world. It's a really nice part of the world.
It is. Yeah. Certainly a hell of a lot better than Sydney, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. That's not hard, though.
At least our Deputy Premier doesn't sue anyone. But another topic for another day.
Yeah. If you're listening to this, Jordan, yeah, we got your back, mate. So I think, have we got any follow-up from the last
show? We do not have any follow-up, so we shall jump straight into the news. A couple of pieces of news here from inside Australia. Two of our most favourite record labels and sort of recording collectives have started some crowdfunding sort
right.
arrangements. So the first one comes from the Birds Robe Records people. Mike Solo, big fan of the show, Mike Solo, mm-hmm. is starting a Kickstarter to record a documentary.
Way ahead.
Going through the 10th anniversary of Birds Robe's records as an entity and sort of, and some of this will be dependent upon, like, you know, they're hoping for like government funding, but you know, in the absence of that, then, you know, it, you know, crowdfunding is the answer. So they're looking to put together a documentary about, or a multi-episode documentary, which will explore the origin and development of Birds Robe as a label, as management, as a touring organization, and also the individual paths of key artists. You know, many of the big prog luminaries of this country, you know, Sleepmax Waves, We Lost the Sea, Tangled Thoughts of Leaving, Toe Hider, all part of this collective. So it should be a very interesting documentary when it comes out.
Absolutely. And you know what, as someone who just went through that whole government not giving things to do big runs of shows and so on and so forth, it's really, really quite critical that people support the arts at the moment, particularly at the moment. You're lucky in the state that we're both currently occupying at the moment, here in WA, the government's been pretty good with that kind of stuff. Unlike in New South Wales, where they basically said, yeah, here's a rock, sink or swim. And you know what? I mean, we just went through that with Bakery Hill, right? We tried to get a whole bunch of funding and such. There was nothing. We couldn't get anything. We ended up doing an Indiegogo, which was reasonably successful. The show was a reasonable success as well. So we were a bit fortunate, but I mean, for fuck's sake, you know, just support the fucking arts. You know what I mean? Like, it'd be great if it was government. But look, if you are interested, I believe there's a whole bunch of, what are they called? Like
there are many tiers of support. So for $10, you can get a digital soundtrack of the documentary when it's available. For $20 or more, you get a CD of your choice from any Bird's Robe artist. Mm-hmm. And then it goes up, you know, through like T-shirts and your name in the end credits. And then there's a... They are also doing a Bird's Robe Record Bandcamp subscription, which we'll get to in a minute. Mm-hmm. So there's a limit of that. And all the way up to the last possible tiers, if you've got $2,500 kicking around, so I don't know if you're Jeff Bezos or similar, then you can get your name out as an executive producer and you get to appear in the film if you wish.
Yeah.
Or contribute to any of the production stuff if you want to as well. So I don't know. I don't have an extra $2,500 kicking around. I don't know about you, Dave.
No, unfortunately.
Yes. The only other one, which unfortunately, as of now, has sold out, was if you donated $1,000 or more, you got a golden ticket, which means you and a named other person get to go to any Bird's Robe show anywhere in the world forever.
That's a cool idea.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but there's only two slots for that, and they're both gone. So,
yeah.
Unfortunately, so.
That's extremely good and extremely generous. Let's just hope they don't do the same thing that the airlines did back in the day. And they're now trying to...
Oh, yeah, American Airlines golden tickets. That's a whole fun story, which we can put a link to in the show notes if you want to know about that, because that is hilarious. So we spoke earlier about Bandcamp subscriptions, and another one of our very most favourite Australian labels, Artist Catharsis, mm-hmm. has put forth a Bandcamp subscription. So for $7 a month, basically what a cup of coffee costs in this state, doesn't it, Dave?
Well, terrible coffee anyways, I found out this morning. No offense to the Padbury that we've got, whatever.
So for $7 a month, you get all the new music we release streaming instantly via the Bandcamp app and also available as a high-quality download.
Hmm.
That's really cool. For $7 a month, that's fantastic value. And you also get a 15% discount on all merchandise, CDs, vinyl, T-shirts, etc. So, I mean, that is incredible value. For $7 a month, you get access to there's prog music in there, there's like jazz music in there, you've also got access to like drone music and all sorts of other very, very interesting styles of music just for $7 Australian dollars a month. So that is incredible value, and I urge everybody to get in on that.
Absolutely.
I certainly will be.
Oh, absolutely. And again, it's a great way to support, a great label.
Totally.
And a great bunch of people. And, I mean, we know Lachlan personally.
Yeah.
He's a great dude and works really hard to promote some really, I would call it strange and wonderful music.
Totally.
You know, a lot of Middle Eastern stuff and stuff that you wouldn't necessarily hear all that much in Australia. So it's absolutely fantastic.
That
this is happening and I mean bargain price, right? You're talking 70, if you're talking an annually thing, you're talking 70, $84 a year.
Yeah.
Like it's next to nothing.
Yeah, you know? Totally.
So
yeah. And $84 a year for basically all of the music coming out of Artist Catharsis.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic.
And I'm assuming it's gonna go into, you know, helping other bands get promoted and such and get them here into Australia and so on and so forth.
You're even just like sorting out touring costs. I mean,
yeah.
I think I've seen Hashashin play twice, once they played here in Perth, and it's a very, very rare day when you get Artist Catharsis label mates to Perth because it's just too hard to get here and all that sort of thing.
Absolutely. As I mentioned in the opening little spiel there, I mean, it's a 5-hour flight, hours and 40 minutes to be exact, but it's, you know, call it 5 hours. It's a long fucking way, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people listening to this from the United States and Europe.
Tickets are not cheap either.
No,
for those, you know.
No, they're not. I mean, you know, if you're listening to this from Europe or, you know, the United States or what have you, it's basically the same as going from one end of the United States to the other end of the United States. So like from Miami to LA.
Yeah.
Basically the same amount of time. Or if you're in Europe, it's kind of like flying from London to
Baghdad, actually.
Is it actually?
Yeah.
London to Baghdad.
London to Baghdad.
There you go. There you go. So you know, it's a long fucking way.
It is a long way.
And that's why it's very hard to... That's why Perth is such a great music scene, such a unique music scene.
Yeah. That's what we've discussed many times on the show before. Yeah, everybody's got to do it themselves. No one's really going to become like super famous out of this city anyway.
Mm.
You know, there are the rare oddities, of course, in Carnival, for example.
Yeah.
And some others, but most of the independent stuff here is like they're just doing it because they love it. They're not doing it because they want to chase the big hits or whatever, because out of this city, it's not going to happen.
Absolutely.
The days of AC/DC reigning the charts are well and truly behind us.
Thank God for that.
Indeed.
Now, you've also got something in here, Hoggy, about a lead-off single from a Dutch progressive rock band, Kayak. It's called Out of This World. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so these guys have been around for a very long time. I think this is their 18th studio album.
Holy shit.
Oh, yeah, they've been around for quite some time.
Jesus.
It's called Out of This World. It will be by the time you hear this, it will have already been out. But as we're recording, we only have the lead-off single Out of This World to listen to. Mm-hmm. In itself, it's actually really cool. There's kind of an orchestral element to it, mm-hmm. Sort of a bit Atlantic kind of quality to it. It's not sort of super Euro prog, as it were. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting, and I'm very much looking forward to listening to this record. It is available to pre-order now on Bandcamp, or by the time you'll have heard this, it'll be available to listen to on Bandcamp. So get out there and have a listen to that.
Normally, we would say something along the lines of, "We're going to do this track by track," but as I'm sure you've all noticed, the release schedule this year has been somewhat haphazard, partly due to Hoggy and my schedules not lining up, and then internet issues and tech issues and a whole bunch of shit that's been going on. Obviously, we are trying to get all that nailed down for you all, but
most of this is my fault. I will hold my hands up. Most of this is my fault. Just, it's 2021 so far this year has been a mad year for me professionally. We'll leave it at that for various reasons, but
yep.
it's just been really hard to get together and do more episodes, but we certainly intend to.
Absolutely.
Just, yeah.
And some more interviews and a whole bunch of stuff. So
absolutely.
Keep everything, keep your finger on the pulse of what we're doing, because it's all pretty fun stuff coming up.
Indeed. So that about leads us to the end of the news. So we should jump into the main topic, which... Well, there's no really real way to kind of dance around this one. We're going to talk about the Liquid Tension Experiment record.
Yeah.
The new one.
Absolutely.
The one that we've all, all of us in the Dream Theater world have been waiting,
20-odd years.
Yeah, 15-some-odd years for this record to come out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
I mean, we also know we're coming at this late. Obviously, this album's been out a little while.
It's been out for a couple of weeks now, yeah.
So, you've probably read all the other interviews and read everything about it and listened to it 55 times, and you're probably going to disagree with us a lot. But that's okay. What did you think overall?
Well, I think part of the appeal of Liquid Tension Experiment when they first came out was like it was a new and kind of fresh musical direction for members of Dream Theater. Now that they've come back to it, and now that 3/4 of the band are in a band together, mm-hmm. There's not a huge amount of separation between the Dream Theater world as it currently exists and the Liquid Tension Experiment. Yes, I know Mike Portnoy has left the band and so on and so forth, but like this still sounds very much centered in the classic, in the giant inverted commas that I'm doing here, the classic Dream Theater sound.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It kind of sounds like Dream Theater from, late 90s, early 2000s without a singer.
Yeah.
But that's ostensibly what we've got.
Yep.
I'll put this here and then we'll come back to it sort of toward the end. There were bits of this album where I felt like it needed a singer.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether or not that's because I'm going, oh, that's old Dream Theater. Where are the vocals? This is a new track I haven't heard. Or if it was simply my musical side coming in and going, no, genuinely, this needs something here.
Because
there were these passages, there were these parts where I could hear the labrie over it. You know what I mean? But it wasn't there.
Or even it just sounded like a sort of a Dream Theater unison section that got taken out of a song or something,
Yeah.
All the Dream Theater unison sections that probably in a bygone era would have ended up on Distance Over Time, but didn't end up on Distance Over Time.
Yeah, exactly. Because that Distance Over Time, I've ranted to you about Barstool Warrior numerous times, where it just feels like it could have gone on for another 5 or 6 minutes and it would have been awesome, but they wanted to make it shorter and more succinct.
They wanted to go away from that, I think,
as a
reaction to The Astonishing, where that was a sort of a bit too much bloat.
I like how it might be a reaction to, The Astonishing, where there was a bit too much bloat. It was Dream Theater does Disney, and it wasn't really wonderful.
Yeah, even members of the band have admitted in interviews that that record is polarizing.
Oh, absolutely.
Which is a nice way of putting it.
Most really good albums are always polarizing, right? So if you look at some of the best albums around, Daft Punk's Random Access Memories, right? That was split right down the middle of the people who wanted them to release another Discovery and the people who thought that they'd just done something amazing.
Yeah.
And it was a genuinely incredible album. Normally that's the case. I can't quite say that for the Astonishing.
No.
Anyway, we're digressing because we never get off the topic on this show.
And, yeah, I was going to say, and we've done that episode already.
You know, but yeah, I tend to agree. It sort of feels like this was just bits of Dream Theater records jammed over and slapped together.
Yeah. Yeah, I think where I think it gets better, where I think it goes into a bit of a different direction and slightly more interesting is, at least the version that we have listened to is the deluxe edition, which the second disc contains some pure 100% improvisation.
Yes.
That stuff is really good.
Absolutely.
I really liked the improvisation stuff where they literally just gone in, pushed record and gone. Yeah. Sort of like on the first album with 3 minute warning.
Yes.
You know, the story goes that, you know, Tony Levin says, you guys have got 3 minutes to sort do your writing bit and then we're doing some improv. You're not doing improv, I'm going home.
Yeah.
And they push record and end up with a 20-minute song.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to listen to that second half of the album and go, okay, so this is what they do when all gloves are off and they've just recorded and that's what it is. And it's really, from a guitarist's perspective, it's really interesting to hear how Petrucci's mind works in that.
Mm.
And obviously Portnoy and Rudess and Levin as well. But, you know, coming from a guitarist's perspective, it's very, very, very interesting to hear that. The second half of the disc, or the second half of the album, the second disc, I think is far much more interesting. I agree with you.
Oh, 100%.
Than the first one. The first one just feels like a clinical...
It feels like they've. Well, I remember we had a question in the earlier part of the thing. It was like, did they sort of do this record by the mail or by Zoom, as it were? Everybody's sitting in at home at Zoom, or did they actually get together? And the answer is yes, they did actually get together at some point to jam, write, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
So maybe in some of that time, they're like, okay, right, we've got these very developed ideas and we're going to write songs because we've got such a limited time.
Mm.
Where the other times they were like, oh, okay, we've just got like an hour here. We're just going to go for it and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the improvised stuff is just definitely more interesting, you know, than the other stuff. I mean, we need to talk about Rhapsody in Blue.
We do. We do.
Like everybody else.
Yes. The adaptation of the orchestral jazz piece by George Gershwin.
Yes. Now, in my opinion, it was gloves off for this. I reckon they just basically stripped it back to everything and just went, right, cool, we're going to make a 20-minute version of this.
And also as well, like, hey, let's take the very famous clarinet glissando at the start and do it on a Chapman stick because fuck it, you know?
Absolutely.
Why not? Let's just do that.
And I mean, if anyone can do it, Levin.
Exactly, exactly. I would love to see more bands do more reinterpretations of the stuff. Maybe bands stop doing it because they're like, oh, everyone, like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer did this several times on several records. You know, Rick Wakeman has reinterpreted bits of Brahms on Yes records and that sort of thing. You know, The Nice with Keith Emerson did stuff like this as well. I think maybe everyone was like, ooh, I don't want to do that because it sounds a bit, you know, bombastic and 70s and stuff. But no, fuck it. I think more people should do it now because there are some great melodies by guys in the Great American Songbook, Gershwin, Porter, etc. You know, Cole Porter, those guys. And some of that stuff could easily be reinterpreted now.
Oh, absolutely.
With the modern instrumentation and the different sounds and stuff, there's plenty of places you could go with it.
Absolutely. I mean, with my band, we were tossing up the idea of doing a jazz standard as one of our songs.
Which one were you going to pick?
We don't know. We kind of got halfway through to talking about it and then the bassist left and we got a new bassist and it kind of went out the window.
The bass player doesn't do jazz, I take it.
The new guy, no, he can.
Yeah.
He's no issues with it. The other guy was more a jazz head though than the other.
I've always thought that something like Miles Davis's Walkin' could be a fun prog thing to reinterpret.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And then that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what, there's a lot of things out there that could be very easily progged up. I mean, even this letting the cat out of the bag a little bit here, but the show that I was in, I've been working on a prog version of that.
Ah.
So doing all the parts and all that. And I'm about a third of the way through the first song. And it's a lot of fun, right? So anyone who's on the podcast who came to the show, one, thank you. Two, that opening number is what I'm currently working on. And it's got, it could be a lot of fun, you know what I mean? So it doesn't necessarily just need to be jazz, but the idea that we can actually, you know, take something from somewhere else that isn't necessarily in the prog sphere and throw it across into, you know, make it proggy, as it were, is a great idea. And, you know, they've definitely done this with Rhapsody in Blue, I mean, to the nth degree.
Totally.
My only concern with it is that it feels rehearsed.
Yeah, well, I think for something like that, though, you kind of have to at least start from the chart somewhere and like, how about we take this part and do this and, you know, we reinterpret this theme with these instruments with, you know, I'll do that one on the guitar and I can do this one on the keyboards or, you know, we'll do the. So I think you have to, there has to be a certain amount of orchestration coming from when you're sort of starting with a standard. I'm not saying you got to like, maybe you don't have to write it and chart it all out, but you certainly got to start somewhere with it, I think.
Oh, absolutely. It felt like it was really, really orchestrated. You know what I mean? Like it was, okay, and then you will do this bit and then you will, as opposed to just jamming it out and seeing what happens. Now, I could be wrong and they could just be that good at what they do that it felt orchestrated.
Possibly. Or what you do is you run the tape a couple of times and you take all the good bit. Oh, that bit's good. That bit was good. That bit was good. And then you sort of like, you know, sort of like how jazz people do it anyway.
Yeah.
You start with the basic theme of whatever.
Yeah.
And then you just sort of improv and over the top and, you know, you reinterpret different melodies or whatever and then go for it. So maybe that's what they did a couple of times and then, oh, we'll take that bit. We'll take that bit. We'll take this bit. Oh, that's a really cool drum part. We'll take that part.
Yeah.
I'd love to know whose idea that was to do Gershwin.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think it was probably, if I had to put money on it, probably Levin.
Possibly, but, yeah.
You know, I mean, I could be wrong, but if I was to hazard a guess, then it would probably be, you know, somewhere around there. I mean, the sound of the album too is a very, very interesting one. In that it was recorded by James Meslin. He's previously done Dream Theater stuff and Petrucci stuff. And it was Rich Mauser who did the mastering. Mixing and mastering, maybe? I'm not sure. Mixing, mastering, one or both. I can't remember. But you know, he's worked with Spock's Beard, Transatlantic, Neil Morse Band.
Yeah, he's done Neil Morse's mixing for years now.
Yeah. You know, I mean, yes, there's breath in it, there's width, there's, you know, you can hear every instrument quite well. It's very crisp. It's clear. It's everything that an album like this absolutely, you know, should be.
But
because of that, because of how polished and amazing and so on, it loses a little bit of the magic of the original ones.
Yeah. The improvisation. I mean? There is a bit of improvisation. I mean, the track Chris and Kevin's Amazing Odyssey.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, that's got all the weird bass tones and the offbeat drumming and stuff. No doubt that was 100% improvised, as were the other ones that were entitled Chris and Kevin's Amazing Whatever.
Yeah.
On the other records.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say so. You know, it's a and you can hear it too in that, because you can bet that Mixing Mastering Man was tearing his hair out with those, because all of a sudden throwing effects on and all that sort of stuff, and you just got to fucking deal with shit instead of, okay, stop that, and then we record the next line and all that sort of stuff under different circumstances. You can hear the dynamicism, I suppose, in the music taking almost a bit of a backseat to what's going on.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. But can we, I mean, I think we need to talk about tones.
Before we talk about tones, though, I want to quickly talk about, like, I think we spoke about in an episode, we were talking about the lead-off single, Hypersonic, and we said that was, like, the safe one.
Yeah.
Not only is it the safe one, I think it's almost like, hey, let's redo, like, the paradigm shift thing from the very first record. Let's open a record with that and, like, you know, the crazy fast runs and the very technical, blah, blah, blah. I think it's like, let's open the record with that.
Yeah.
And it's the safe one.
Yeah. And I mean, they know their audience, right?
Totally.
Because no Dream Theater fan is going to look at that and go, this is terrible.
True. And also as well, if you're going to open a record with something, it may as well be that.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, let's do a callback to the first record when we're trying to make a statement of like, this is the thing. And now we're coming back 20 some odd years later.
Yeah.
Here it is again.
Exactly. It's like we haven't gone anywhere. We're still here. We're still relevant. Well, but you know, they're still just as, you know, amazing at their job as they ever have been, which is great. And that's really fantastic. The rest of the album kind of follows the same suit, though.
Yeah, that's the problem. It's kind of, I mean,
I was drawn more towards the more soulful ends of John Petrucci's guitar playing rather than the mad shredding because, well, I've heard the mad shredding. It all is the mad shredding. And
we've seen the mad shredding.
We have, several times.
I've been at a Dream Theater concert where Petrucci was literally playing, not literally as in figuratively, like all you young whippersnappers like to sort of pretend it means, literally in the original dictionary definition of the term of something actually happening, literally playing too fast and fucking up Metropolis Part 1. I've been there. I've seen it.
Yeah.
It's incredible. The guy's a god when it comes to shredding and amazing stuff. But where Petrucci's real talent has always lied, in my opinion, is his soulful, beautiful solos that he plays.
Yes.
You think of all the best Petrucci solos of all of his entire career. None of them are really the super duper shreddy, crazy bullshit ones, right?
I'm thinking like Hollow Years, Take Away My Pain, Breaking All Illusions, or even The Spirit Carries On.
Thank you. That's what I was thinking of.
Yes.
the big one. The Spirit Carries On, Lines in the Sand, all of those. That's where his stuff shines through, in my opinion. It always has.
Unfortunately, I think that's where it is. But for the fans, I think, is generally there's was it you who was telling me about a guitar clinic you went to and someone's like, do the Glass Prison bit? Yeah. And you can almost see John roll his eyes. Like, God, here we go again,
Yeah. And I mean, if you want shred stuff, dare I say it, I know Petrucci is, the guy that everybody looks up to.
Mm.
My opinion, Stephen Taranto wipes the fucking floor with him.
I was going to say, and if you want shred, proper, shred stuff, Yngwie.
Yeah.
For that, if you want the ultimate end member of shred guitar. Yeah.
How many notes can I play in how little time?
Exactly. And with no hammer-ons and no pull-offs and straight, alternate picking and a whole bit, that is Yngwie.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Gilbert is the same, but Petrucci has that soul side to him, which makes it very different. But when he's doing the super-duper shreddy stuff is impressive, but it doesn't really do much.
There also has to be, I suppose, when you're writing songs, actual songs with melodies and lyrics, there has to be an element of slight sort of pop, even pop in massive inverted commas sensibility to the playing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the shredding stuff works well when it's like a solo endeavor. Mm. When you're trying to write melodies, that doesn't work. Yeah. There's nothing there.
There's that one that was on his solo album, Out of the Blue, right? Bluesy as, and my favorite track on the entire album. Because it wasn't just Shreddy McShredface.
Yes.
Right? Maybe this is just me getting the, I don't know. Maybe I'm just getting old and jaded, right?
Yeah.
I just, the Shreddy sort of stuff really just, it's not doing my head in. I'm just getting really jaded on, really burnt out.
I think part of the problem as well is I hear those sort of bits and I'm just like, I've heard this before. Maybe, it's probably not the same scale and it's probably not the same tempo or whatever, but just the feel of it is just I've heard this before.
Yep.
The trill at the end and then back into the riff. It's like, we've heard that already.
Exactly.
And everyone else is doing, the problem is everyone else is doing it.
That's right. There was a great video on YouTube a little while ago. I think it was by Gear Gods. And this guy, the main guy who does the Gear God stuff, was like, I'm going to write a Dream Theater style song, right? And he wrote it. He writes this song and close your eyes, except for the singing, right? But you close your eyes and you're like, yeah, that literally sounds like modern day Dream Theater. Like it's their style is so unique that you hear it and you go, bang, that's Dream Theater clearly, which is no mean feat, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's more than most pop people can say. Because 1465 is going to be the fucking same.
Yeah, exactly.
1464 or whatever.
Yeah. You can have the minor fall and the major lift.
Yeah, exactly. It's all kind of the same, right? But it is interesting that they are, I mean, Dream Theater obviously are one of the big, big guys, right?
Yeah.
So you hear people go, oh, that sounds like Dream Theater. That sounds like Tool. That sounds like Periphery are getting it now.
Yeah.
Mick Gordon's getting it as well.
I think it's because that next generation of kids who grew up listening to Dream Theater records in the back. Like, you know, how the way that Dream Theater people listen to Iron Maiden, like people in that sort of era listen to Iron Maiden and Pink Floyd and all that. Yep. The kids coming up now have been listening to Dream Theater. I mean, listening to Tool, listening to Haken and all that sort of stuff. And now they sort of sound like them.
That's right.
Just going back to your topic about the guy who wanted to write the Dream Theater song.
Yeah.
Did you see the bit that Mike Mills did on Facebook where he had like an AI try and finish off a song for him?
No.
Oh, he did. He took like the first part of his hilarious song, How Do Ghosts Work? And he said, take the first half and then puts it into an AI, and the AI comes up with some wacky stuff. And it was like, they've done this with Hendrix songs. They've done this with Nirvana.
They've done it with a Eurovision song too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. I got to see that.
Fantastic.
See, this is the thing. Like, I reckon, like, if someone hasn't done it yet, I'd love to see it. Like, the AI Dream Theater composition.
We should do that.
There must be a program. There are programs out there. You can sort of feed into it what you want.
We should definitely do that.
We totally should.
Yeah.
We should give it a go.
We'll get it. We'll give it a go and we'll put it on the next show.
Yeah, I think so.
I think it would be hilarious.
Or or even our long defunct like band podcast Bandcamp page.
Oh God, hilarious.
Yeah. I don't think it does lyrics though. Does it do lyrics?
I don't know.
No, that's right. The Nirvana one, they had a guy who was in like a Nirvana cover band do the lyrics that the computer spat out.
Yeah, right.
So it sounds like Kurt Cobain, but actually isn't Kurt Cobain. Huh. It just sounds like him. Right. It's quite a close facsimile of it. Let's see if I can find a link for it in the show notes. It's very interesting.
We need to do that. We need to do that.
Trying to find someone that sounds like James LaBrie, though. I don't know. That might be a bit tricky. You willing to take that one on, Dave?
Oh, I'll give it a go. Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it. It's actually really, it was quite funny. Slight addendum here.
This is the addendum to the addendum now.
The addendum to the addendum, yeah. So before you do any show, if you've got mics on, you obviously have to do a mic check.
Yep.
Right? And this is the same in musical theater as well.
Yep.
And what we did was there's often a theme. So the whole idea is the cast all knows the theme, but the audio guy doesn't, and he has to try and guess what the theme is, right? So the first one we did was Gender Bender. So you had to sing a song by the opposite gender.
Right, okay.
So I did Jolene in the original key.
Right.
Right. It started where I started, went up, nailing, not a problem, you know. And then he was like, okay. The guy's like, fuck, what the fuck? And the director's sitting down the front and he's just going, how? Because, you know, my normal singing in this was, you know, much more around this sort of, that sort of stuff.
Right? Not too much of the high stuff.
Not a lot of the high stuff at all. So I'm dropping into this other register. He's going, what the fuck? Where are you? I've got a 4-octave vocal range, man. What do you want? And then I'm going up the stairs and the lead guy, a guy who played Ross, James, coming down, who I had on the show. And he goes, man, you started way too high on that. And I just went, yeah, you're jealous. And he went, yeah, I am a little bit. Sorry, mate, fuck off. But no, it's a very, very interesting sort of world, right? So I absolutely would be willing to give the James LaBrie claw hand a go. God knows.
Do we send it to Dream Theater though? There's the question.
Sorry, what?
When we make their fake song in their style with an AI people, do we like send it to them?
Absolutely. Hey, fucking oath. See what happens.
Yeah.
You know, I know Dream Theater commented on the other one, on the Gear Gods one.
Oh, yeah.
They were like, holy shit, this is amazing.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, okay.
You know,
yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
But we digress.
We do. We do.
We were, before we were taking this, I brought up the point of tones.
Yes. We were going to get back to tones.
Right. I have a sneaking suspicion you have much to say about Mike's drumming.
The problem that I have with Mike's drumming, and look, we all know how great the drummer Mike Portnoy is.
Mm-hmm.
But so far as like, I mean, I've heard drummers, you know, maybe this is rather uncharitable to compare. Maybe this is like when Lars Ulrich said, oh, I'm no Mike Portnoy, like several years ago when people were talking about Lars being a really great drummer. Maybe this is the problem I have with Mike Portnoy is that I'm comparing him to guys like Gavin Harrison and Pat Mastelotto and stuff who have developed their drumming and gone off into much different places over the course of their career, where Mike is very much, he's got his toolbox and that's kind of it.
Yeah.
He's using, like, there are many, the only thing I didn't hear on this record, maybe I'm forgetting it, but I was like, I don't think I heard any octobans on this record.
There were definitely some octobans.
Not many. Okay, cool. Well, at least he's walked back the octoban part. Everything else is there. All the other major fills and
yeah,
you know, that's all there.
Yeah, no, so, I agree with you. I Mike, and this is where the two mics argument comes in. Now, I want to put a little disclaimer here.
Here we go. Here we go with the two mics argument again.
This is unpopular opinion territory. I'm aware that this is a podcast with the two, you know, heads of the Dream Theater Fan Club of Australia and New Zealand. And if you want to turn in your membership cards for the comments that we make, that's fine. Leave them on the desk. We don't care. In my opinion, and I believe I've said this before on the show, but in my opinion, Mike Mangini is a better drummer than Portnoy.
If we're talking technically,
yes,
that's not even a contest.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking technically, he is a much better drummer. He always will be. The guy's a monster. Like, he can do shit with one hand that Portnoy can't do with two. You know what I mean? Like, it's just ridiculous. But Portnoy's strength was in the fact that he had his toolkit.
Yes.
Right. So if you look at Mangini, right, he had his stuff with Annihilator, and then he had his stuff with Steve Vai, and then he had his stuff with Petrucci as well.
He did some James LaBrie solo records as well.
James LaBrie stuff. He's a chameleon, right?
Yes.
And that makes him exceedingly, amazingly, holy shit level of good. But as happened with when the Petrucci album first came out, and there was that teaser trailer, and there was that single hit. And I looked at you, I turned to you and went, that's Portnoy. That is never going to happen with Mangini.
No.
Right? He does not have a signature. I mean, I'm sure everyone thinks he has a signature sound and all that sort of stuff. But because he's that much of a chameleon, he can sort of drop into wherever he wants to drop
into. And also as well, arguably, that's what got him hired by Dream Theater. You watch back to that documentary and you look at all the other drummers and all the other drummers around, well, like their spin and their sound on the songs. And that was pretty much met with an unqualified no. From the rest of the Dream Theater fans, like, no, we don't want that. We want, you know, or we think the fans want what they can, like, what they hear in the record. They don't want, like, individual changes sort of stuff. Yeah. Maybe they're just worried about it, like a Blaze Bailey kind of situation.
Well,
or,
I mean,
you know,
that's why Marco Minniman got very heavily considered as well and turned it down.
Did he turn it down?
Yeah, he turned it down.
Did he?
Yes, he was.
They didn't spin that on the documentary.
No, so he basically walked away from it and went, this isn't for me. Now, whether or not he walked away before they made the offer and Mike was indeed their first choice or what have you, I don't know. I don't know the sides of that.
Yeah.
But I know that Minniman walked away.
Interesting. Because I know there were several other drummers that were approached to audition and went, nah, I'm good.
Yeah, exactly. Which is very interesting. It would have been hilarious to see Harry Myrie there, actually. But anyway. So
I think they were looking, they wanted like big name people.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, who wouldn't?
Yeah.
But it is that thing with Mike's drumming, is Portnoy's drumming, is that it is instantly recognizable. And when he and Petrucci get together, they worked together for, what, 30-odd years? It's going to work. What they do is amazing. It's really good work. It's fantastic stuff.
There's a musical language there that is an understanding you just don't get.
Absolutely.
You know, immediately. It comes from... Having worked together since you were literally teenagers.
That's right. And it's exactly it. And that screams through in this album. Like, absolutely screams through. And it screamed through in the Petrucci solo album too. You know, there's a particular... He obviously writes... Because he's worked with Portnoy for so long, or worked with Portnoy for so long, he obviously writes with that in mind.
Yes.
Right? So he writes with that sound. Dare I say it, the sound of the Tama kit and the Sabian cymbals and all of that, and the way that Portnoy does the strokes and the octobands.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, also just the sound of just him.
Yes.
You know, just like it's Mike Portnoy and behind the kit doing the thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I mean, that all works, right? But when it comes to Mangini, Mangini's that much of a freaking chameleon. He can just do whatever. And he'll get 98% of the way there. But for the hardcore fans, and I would put myself in a hardcore fan category, although I don't have any tattoos or anything, we'll notice it.
Yeah.
Right?
You were also saying something similar about John Petrucci's guitar tone as well. There's like some changes there from the... But I think, here's my personal theory, I think those changes are necessary. There are so many goddamn guitar players out there running around ripping off the John Petrucci sound. Oh, he's like, oh no, I'm just going to develop it a bit further or change some things or whatever to kind of move past the
20,000 other people that sound just like him on the internet.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the amount.
I mean, that sounds really snobby, but it isn't, because most of these people we're listening to are like, you know, the debut or maybe the second record or something sort of thing. It's like if you go back to John Petrucci and his second record, you know, it was like there's a bit of Steve Vai, there's a bit of Holdsworth, there's a bit of Aldemiola, there's a bit of this, bit of that, all mixed together in a soup, and then eventually develop that into kind of his own sound. So perhaps though, you know, we're still waiting for those other people to kind of develop past the John Petrucci thing.
Yeah, I mean, look, it could be that. I mean, there's also been, I mean, if you just take the, and this is getting techie for a second, but if you take the pickups in his guitars, right, they've always changed. So there was, in the early days, I'm pretty sure they were DeMars. It was an Air Norton and a Steve Special or something originally. And then he put the Dropsonic in there, and then he created his own pickups, and then, which is the Illuminator and the Liquifier, I think. And then he's got the new ones, the Dream Scaper and the fucking I don't know what. But obviously that's, I think that was probably due to the changes in the guitar's body and neck and all that kind of stuff. He says that the neck has not changed. Yeah, look, I'm not going to disagree with the guy that, you know, did the guitar, but it's definitely different. If you feel the old JP6s right through to the Majesty and the JP15s.
Are there any other places that change could come from, though, not just from the neck? There are, must be other, many other different things that can change.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the shape of the body has changed. So originally it was kind of a bit more slanted to the front, sort of like a racing car, like a cartoon racing car accelerating. And now, then it became a little bit more symmetrical. And then now, obviously, the big change with the Majesty, it's completely changed.
That's
the whole
interesting. Forgive my ignorance. I was not aware that, like, the shape of an electric guitar. I understand how the shape of an acoustic guitar can change the sound, but the shape of an electric guitar, I don't understand how that could change the sound.
Look, it can. There are so many different schools of thought on this. In my opinion, 90% of it comes from pick up in your hands.
Yeah.
But those little subtle changes are enough for people to figure it out, right? So, I mean, Telecasters, for example, have a very unique tone. Strats have a very unique tone.
I thought that was more about the choice of wood as opposed to the shape of the thing.
Look, they say that. Oh, you know, older sounds more snappy and mahogany sounds different to this. And
the vintage guitar argument sounds like just wanky bollocks for me. That just sounds like inventions by the guitar companies to keep the stock in the old stuff high. Otherwise, it will all end up in the scrap heap.
To me, I tend to agree with you on that. Mm. I don't think there's a huge difference except for weight. For me, I like a weighty guitar. I like something that sits on me and I know it's there, which is incredibly bad for my back, as anyone who
I was going to say, this is why, like, you see guys, you know, wear the guitar really high and it's quite light, and they do it because they're doing lots of technical things and they want to be in the right posture for it.
That's right.
Hence the John Petrucci, like, foot stand sort of thing. He uses the stand to get himself in the posture to do the thing so he can maintain correct posture.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which is fair enough when you're, you know, pushing 60, I guess.
Well, yeah. And I mean, that's definitely part of it. Also, Petrucci's guitars are basswood, which is an incredibly light guitar timber.
Yeah.
With mahogany tone inlays, right? The version that I have of his guitar is actually mahogany. It's solid mahogany with the ebony fretboard, so it's kind of built like the Les Pauls, and it weighs a ton, and it's fucking fantastic because you know it's there.
Yeah.
As opposed to this thing that you pick up and go, oh, fucking, where is it, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, the tone itself, I tend to agree with you, and I know that we've had this conversation on it as well, but yeah, he kind of just, so many people are copying his tone. I mean, if I see another prick on YouTube, oh, here's my new guitar setup. Oh, look, it's a Petrucci signature with the Petrucci signature amp. How fucking original.
Yes, you indeed. Know? But this is like, this happens in all the sub communities as well.
Of course.
This is a better conversation to have off air, but in, like, you know, the sort of like the beauty community and stuff, everybody's got the same bags and everybody's got the same stuff. And it's like, well, where's the original things? Like,
I mean, I understand if it's genuinely the best of the best, right? I get that, right? You know, if you're going to buy for example, a camera bag, chances are you're going to be buying an Onar bag, maybe. I mean, Lau Pro are extremely good, but they're cheap. You know, there's a whole bunch of ones that are decidedly quite good.
Yeah.
And you do them. If you're going to buy a leather bag, you're buying Saddleback leather.
Yeah.
If you've got the money. That's it. They're the best of the best. You know what I mean?
Totally.
And Music Man guitars, I own 5 of them. They're extremely good. I love them. I genuinely think they're the best guitars in the market, right? And most people will recognize that as well. Most people who know what they're talking about, if you say you play, the guys in the show, when we were talking, I was talking with the other guitarists, and they're like, oh, so what do you run and everything? I was explaining some of my gear. Now, what guitars do you use? I said, oh, Music Man. And they're like, oh, fuck yeah, nice. You know, everyone knows.
I suppose if you're playing that style of music, if you're playing the prog metal.
Yeah.
If you're playing metal, maybe not even prog metal, just like metal, you go Music Man. If you're playing blues, depending on which way you want to go, straddle telly.
Yeah, exactly. PRS as well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, PRS is another big one. But
isn't a PRS basically a strat? I mean, I don't want to start a war here, but I watched a video once.
It's the other way around. So Music Man was born out of Fender.
Yeah.
And PRS are basically the new Les Pauls, if you will. But they've got the double cutaway bodies. Anyway, we will lose the whole show to guitar nerdy shit spec if I keep going on with that.
Indeed. That's a different show to have with other people.
Absolutely.
maybe I could be like the facilitator, but I'm definitely not contributing.
I tend to agree with you in that I think Petrucci's best era of tone, in my opinion, was that mid-90s. So basically everything from mid-90s to mid-2000s. So everything from, I would put Images and Words in there, but not my favorite. But everything from, you know, Falling into Infinity probably right through till Octavarium.
Yeah. Right?
And live too. I mean, the Score DVD, anyone who's seen the Score DVD, his live tone on that is just immaculate.
Yes.
So good. But now he's sort of getting so far into the metal category, there's nothing there for it to breathe.
Yeah. I feel like there was that. I feel like that was sort of the problem towards the end of like the Roadrunner era.
Yeah.
The back end of the Roadrunner era was like, we're going for the shred, we're going for the metal.
Yeah.
We're going in that direction. And, you know, I don't know who influenced it. I don't know whose idea it was, but that was the direct. And I was kind of like, eh. Mm, mm.
Like, don't get me wrong. I love Systematic Chaos as an album. It's one of my favorites of theirs. And I know that's going to be met with pitchforks and.
Oh, look, I'm sure it wouldn't matter which album you named as your favorite. You're going to get the pitchforks. So yeah, it's just kind of like, just roll with it and duck the pitchforks. Yeah.
Unless it's Wind Dream and Day Unite, in which case everyone just laughs you off. But yeah, I don't know. Look, the album itself, in my opinion, the LTE3, was it good? Yes, it was technically brilliant. I'm not sure it was progressive enough. Not as in it wasn't prog music because it was prog music, but it wasn't.
Yeah, I guess it all before. The whole point, the original point of the Liquid Tension Experiment was to kind of develop something outside of the Dream Theater University. Yeah. And then they kind of put it on the shelf because it became the Dream Theater Universe essentially. And with this particular record, like, I understand why they did it because there is obviously an opportunity to kind of develop something, you know, especially in a pandemic era where you can't tour, you got to put a record out. It's like, hey, let's put together a Liquid Tension Experiment record. Is there going to be a fourth one? If there is, cool, but I probably won't be standing in the queues in the rain at night time to queue up to buy it.
No, me neither. It was a good album, but I was just bored. I got bored with it.
Yeah, the improvisational stuff in the second disc was definitely my favorite part of it. And if that was the only thing they'd put out, I'd be happy with that.
Yeah.
But the stuff where they've written and done other things, the cover of Rhapsody in Blue was pretty cool. Yeah. But apart from that, the rest of it is mostly pretty forgettable.
Yes.
For me, anyway.
It sounds like the shred from any other person that could have done that sort of stuff.
Well, it just sounds like offcuts from a Dream Theater record.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, so look, we will accept your angry emails and tweets. You can do that through the contact link button, which is in the show notes.
And you can also tweet us at 98FM.
Yeah, absolutely. Engage us. Tell us why we're wrong, and we'll promise we won't block you and delete you like certain members of parliament here in Australia who want free speech but aren't happy to take criticism. So,
indeed.
I think that's about covers the main topic.
I think it does.
We should jump into our album reviews.
The record that I gave you was by local Perth band Mount Mountain. The album was called Centre. What did you think of it?
Look, not the sort of stuff I normally listen to be honest with you. A bit more jangly. Probably what I'm really, really used to playing or listening to. You know, short album too.
Yeah.
About 40 minutes for 9 songs.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It was interesting. That's what I will say. And it's...
There is an element of that Triple J rock kind of thing to it, which is where they came from. This record's very different. The record's very different from the other ones. It very much was like jangle, guitars, big reverb on the vocals. There's not so much of that on this record. This one's in a slightly darker place than where they came from.
This album reminded me quite a bit of Spiritualized, a band from the UK, noise rock band from the UK, who I have seen. Fantastic show at the Opera House in Sydney. Would I necessarily be lining up to see them? Probably not. But it was definitely worth a listen, and there was some cool shit in there, you know. Stuff that, you know, I took away and sort of went, okay, yeah, that's different. Yeah, I don't know. Should you listen to it as a if you're a massive prog fan, you're one of these prog fans that listens to like three bands and they all start with Dream and end in Theatre, then probably not. But you know what? If you've got a bit of a bigger appreciation for music, yeah, give them a crack. See what happens.
Alrighty.
Now, the one I gave you, The Elephant in the Room. Now, this was their self-titled album. What'd you think?
Well, this album was cool sounding. There's lots of different moods there. Unfortunately, the one thing that I heard and couldn't unhear was, as we've discussed ad nauseum through the main show already, was almost the pedal-for-pedal copying of John Petrucci's guitar tone, which is a malaise that's currently affecting all the prog metal right now, and it does my bloody head in. Look, I really like John Petrucci. I really like his guitar playing. Hell, we've dedicated several episodes on this show to records he's featured on, but it's really frustrating to hear incredibly talented players just copying his tone and copying his choice of, like, you know, solo scale fragments and stuff like that. It just does my bloody head in. Yeah. You know, cool sounding record. I mean, instrumental prog metal records, you've got to bring something different to the table, I think. If you're just doing like instrumental sort of stuff that sounds like Dream Theater or whatever, you know, it's not going to be super entertaining for me to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely.
It might sound like a knock on this record, but again, you know, if you like that sort of stuff, it's a pretty cool record. Check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the reason I gave it to you, because I was like, there's enough Petrucci in here, I think, that you'll pick up the fact of it's someone sort of I'm not going to say copying, but definitely taking heavy influence.
Yeah, very heavy influences from, exactly.
So, yeah, there you go. What have you got for me for this, whenever the next episode is?
So this record I'm going to give to you is from a UK-based musical collective. Always love the musical collectives, called Ezra Collective. Okay. It's a record out last year called You Can't Steal My Joy. Mm-hmm. Have a listen to that and tell me what you think.
All right.
What have you got for me?
I have a brand new prog album, came out this year, a couple of weeks ago, by a band called Trope, as in a trope. And it is called Eleutheromania.
Okay.
Eleutheromania. I'm assuming I'm saying that correctly. I don't know. It's a word I don't recognize. But give it a listen and let me know what you think.
All righty.
Awesome.
So that about wraps it up for this episode of the 9-8 podcast. If you would like to find the show notes for this episode, you can find them at the98podcast.fireside.fm/71. You can find us on Twitter at 98FM. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/98FM. All the links to these will be in the show notes below. And as Dave mentioned, if you wish to get in touch with us, send us some of your own music for us to listen to, or send us some of your criticisms of our opinions about John Petrucci's guitar tone, feel free, go for it.
Absolutely, absolutely. As always, thank you so much for listening to two people, often on opposite sides of the continent, but today sitting next to each other, rant on about prog music, and we'll see you on the very next episode of the 9-8 podcast. My name is Dave Ellis.
My name is Alex Hogg. Thank you all very much. We'll see you later.
See you then.